It starts with an itch and a tingle, and then it builds and expands. And suddenly, all at once, my legs won't let me stand. I scratch till my fingers go numb, but my skin never bleeds. A silent accomplice waits and feeds when I'm asleep. There's something that lives inside me. I promise I never. With an itch and a tingle, and then it builds and expands. And suddenly, all at once, my legs won't let me stand. I scratch till my fingers go numb, but my skin never bleeds. A silent accomplice waits and feeds when I'm asleep.
Night Media Studios and Paranormal Underground Magazine. Welcome to Paranormal Underground Radio. It's time to explore the unexplained with your hosts, Rick Hale and Karen Frazier.
Well, hello everybody, and welcome to another Thursday night edition of Paranormal Underground Radio on Z-Talk Radio.
You know where you're supposed to be.
That's right, exactly where you're supposed to be. I am Karen Frazier, and with me, as you hear, is Rick Hale.
Hello, everybody. Hello, hello, hello.
Rick, I am so excited.
About?
We're talking Dybbuk Box tonight.
You know what? It takes a lot to make me kind of like put me on edge, but for whatever reason, the Dybbuk box puts me on edge.
I know. I love it. I mean, I don't love that you're on edge, but for some reason, the Dybbuk box is like, ever since I learned about the Dybbuk box, maybe about 3 years ago now, two, 3 years ago. And ever since I read the story of the Dybbuk box, I was so excited about it. And I don't know why, because I see those haunted things, haunted items on eBay all the time. Mm-hmm. And those don't get me excited. But the Dybbuk box is just, there's something about it that I love it.
Well, I think with the, when it comes to the Dybbuk box, I do believe that there might be something to it. Mm-hmm. Unlike, you know, buy a ghost in a bottle. You know, it's like, you know, of course, being the, paranormal investigator that I am, I always go to eBay quite a bit and look at all that kind of stuff. You get like, you know, haunted bottles, haunted television, haunted computers. I mean, everything has a ghost. And if it has a ghost, dear God, it is going to sell.
That's right. I know. That's what's so funny about it is how can anybody verify most of the stuff on eBay that sells that's haunted is authentic?
Right.
You know, it's but I don't feel that way about the Dybbuk box. I look at those haunted objects on eBay, and for the most part, I sort of think, okay, a fool and his money are soon parted. But,
exactly.
But there's something that just, as I was first reading the story of the Dybbuk box, in the core, in my gut, it was just there, you know? It's almost like when I first heard about Wellington, it was just there. It's like, yes, this is it. So so I love the story of the Dybbuk box, and it's got a lot of, the box has a lot of really exciting things coming up that Jason and Kevin Manis, the first owner, is with us tonight too, and they're going to be talking about, but there's a book coming up, there's a movie coming up, so we're riding at the crest of the wave of the Dybbuk box with this here radio broadcast.
You know what would be awesome about the Dybbuk box? If they could just like unleash the Dybbuk box on like some neo-Nazi group, you know, and just watch them like run roughshod all over this group, man, and just send them out screaming and stuff. Because let's face it, you know, the Dybbuk box is, or the, you know, the Dybbuk is a, you know, a Jewish spirit, of course.
Well, and the box has a Holocaust connection.
Exactly. So, I mean, just, you know, just watching, you know, a bunch of scumbag neo-Nazis running scared would be awesome. Love it.
Well, yeah, so I'm really excited. So we're going to have Jason Haxton, who is the current owner of the Dybbuk box, and Kevin Manis, whose story about his experience with the Dybbuk box, he's the guy who originally bought it at the estate sale when the family sold it. And his story is really hair-raising, and it's So it's going to be a really great conversation. I'm really excited about that. So I'm looking forward to just a few minutes. Saturday this last week, I think I told you last week, I did ghost camp with the kids.
Yeah, how was it? You know, I was going to ask you that. How did that go?
It was great. The kids were between, I think, 8 and 12, I think, was the age group. Mm-hmm. So they were in that age group where they're still, where they're old enough that they're not going to be scared spitless.
Right.
You can change letters if you'd like to make it what I really intended to say. And but they're young enough that they've seen the stuff on TV. They're really curious about it. They're excited about it. So we had a really good time with the kids. There were probably about 10 kids. One of them was Mr. Skeptic, and he was awesome. Mr. Skeptic was the best because, you know, I don't believe any of this, blah, blah, blah. And by the end of the time,
hold on a second. Was that his name? Is his name like Bill Skeptic or something?
No, I think his name was Thomas. But he was maybe about, I guess, I'd put him at about 10 or 11, somewhere in there, a little, you know, not quite at the top of the age range, but right there. And he was all skeptical, and he had the skepticism written in his eyes and everything
else.
This is a kid.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
And then we took him through there, and we sat down, and we did an EVP session in one of the parts of the museum, and then we sent them on their way, and I analyzed the audio, because we only did like a 15-minute EVP session, and by God, if we didn't get an EVP for him.
Really?
Yeah, it was kind of great. I should have sent it to Cheryl so we could have played it on the show, but we did. We got an EVP. One of the kids said, what's your favorite animal? And this voice, there's like about a 4 or 5 second pause, and a voice says, tiger.
See, now I love that when you got a skeptic there and you can show them some hardcore proof, it's the look in their eyes is almost like it's disappointment. Like, holy cow, I've been wrong my entire life.
That's right. And when you're 10, there you got a lot of stake in whether you've been right or wrong your entire life.
Yeah. You know,
I'm 10 years old. I'm not thrashing the hopes of 10-year-olds, dang it.
Way to go, Karen.
I know. No, so he was, so when that EVP was played, boy, his face changed and he was like, woo. And so we asked him, do you think it's haunted? Yeah. it was great.
Now, let me ask you this. When people send their, obviously these are children of people. I mean, definitely. I mean, how are the parents with that kind of thing? Do they like, well,
children of people. No, no.
You know what I'm trying to say.
Spawn of the devil they were. Yeah, I do know. And actually, I thought that SS South Sound Paranormal Research actually handled this quite well. What mm-hmm. they did is that they had their whole setup in the museum, including all of their cameras and things.
Okay.
And so they had the DVR set up on the screen, on a big screen in the front of the room. They took the parents into the back room and let them watch what the kids were doing.
Okay.
And they had people there who were answering the parents' questions as things came up and had conversations. So I would say most of these parents were probably people who had some closet interest themselves in the paranormal. Mm-hmm. I don't think that, you know, if a parent had a real problem with that, I don't think they would let their child go.
Oh, no, definitely not. I mean, there must be some kind of a belief there where, you know, and they're trying to share that with their kid. I mean, I know, you know, the Theodore Nicholas, the future world's greatest paranormal investigator who's sleeping upstairs right now, you know, he's 7 months old. And, I've actually made the promise to my wife that that I won't, you know, push this kind of stuff on him. Mm-hmm. But this is going to be like his birthright, more or less. And yeah. I'm hoping that he does have an interest.
Well, here's what your wife is going to find out is that regardless of what you are or are not going to push on your children, your mm-hmm. child is going to know exactly the things he's interested and wants to do, and he's going to do them.
Yeah, I'm kind of hoping that one day Theo will, you know, bring me before his class and, you know, have me bring all my equipment and be like, this is my dad. He's a psychical investigator. And then I just get to tell a bunch of stories because, you know, that's
yeah.
That's
part and if of the he fun. Does it like when he's in like kindergarten career day or something, mm-hmm. you can hear the bejesus out of those kids. The ones in diapers will be happy they're still in diapers that they never got potty trained.
Yep. So one day he may find himself at the paranormal camp. So I'm all for that.
At Kids Ghost Camp. Yeah, Kids and Ghost you know, camp, it yeah. was so successful that the museum's been getting calls asking, will we do it for adults and will we do it for older kids?
Now, what museum is this exactly?
It's the Lewis County Historical Museum. I actually wrote an article about it that appeared in which issue, Cheryl? Cheryl. She's not going to answer.
Oh my God! I'm sorry. I just took a bite of a hamburger.
That's okay.
I'm sorry. And I'm sorry, but I have no clue what issue was.
All right, well, it was one of the issues. It's also, if you want to read about the museum, it's actually on my personal webpage, which is KarenFrazier.com. It's on the homepage of my webpage as one of my more recent articles I wrote. So mm-hmm. it's there as well. But it's a great museum. And then we stayed after the kids left, and we investigated with, I think there were 3 or 4 groups there. Mm-hmm. And it was really interesting because past is present. You remember Ellen?
Yeah.
Yeah, the ghost elbowed her in the ribs really hard She was sore several days later. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And she had one of her cameras like ripped off the wall. It was really weird. We were sitting back in the where the DVR setup was, and we were watching this strange light anomaly by this camera. It was like this really weird, almost like somebody was playing a flashlight beam around the floor, but there was nobody out there. We were the only ones in the museum. There was nothing that would cause this. And so we went to sneak around and peek in the front door of the museum, because if there was activity, we didn't want to disturb it. We just wanted to see it. Sure. And as we were sneaking around the outside, somebody heard a rip, and the camera actually was ripped off the wall.
So no, hold on a second. I got a question. You, yeah. Obviously, you have a very aggressive entities. You know, you got the leader, the camp director or whatever, being elbowed and being in pain days later.
We didn't take them to where the elbowing ghost hangs out.
Oh, okay.
That's
all
in
right.
The attic, and we didn't take the kids there. There is a ghost that tends to be a little aggressive sometimes up in that attic. Mm-hmm. It's throwing things and everything else, and we didn't take the kids there. So they got to do, but there's other places as well. Oh, Cheryl just sent me something, and I can barely see it, but I think it maybe says it was January of 2011.
Yeah, yes. January 2011.
I'm sitting in Jim's chair again, and it's really far away from the screen, so that's why I'm not chatting with anybody in the chat room or responding to people's things, because I can't see it. So, hey, it's 6:16. We're wasting time. I mean, not that you and I aren't fascinating, but I really want to come back talking with Kevin and Jason, because it's just the best story.
Okay, well, but before we go, I just want to warn everybody, do not mock the box. I did the last time, and I am not lying to you guys when I tell you this. My eyes were burning.
That's right. Bizarre.
So.
That's right. So in just a couple minutes, we will be back on Paranormal Underground Radio on Z-Talk Radio, and we will not be mocking the box. We'll be right back.
Hi, everybody. Lee Douglas. I want to invite all of you 50s and 60s music lovers to listen to Old Time Rock and Roll, the largest oldies podcast in the world today, with a 110,000 song playlist. Our shows are always available 24/7. Go to www.oldtimernr.com. We have two new shows each week, and we take requests and dedication just like the old days. That's oldtimernr.com. Come on over and join the fun.
If you are a small business owner, you are paying too much for products and services. Do not spend your hard-earned cash on items you can get on trade. UTXTrade.com was formed specifically so you can trade your products or services with other companies on the network for items like advertising, computer repair, office furniture, printing, hotel stays, and much more. For more information, please visit UTXTrade.com. That's UTXTrade.com, a proud sponsor of Paranormal League of America.org.
I know what you are. You drive too fast, you smell so good, and you dress fashionably well.
Say it out loud.
You're a metrosexual?
Oh, why do I always get that? I'm a radio show host.
Kale, I want to be one of you.
And you can be. Join me on ztalkradio.com, 9 p.m. Eastern on Sunday nights. The show's called Perspective.
Hey, do you sparkle?
Oh my God, don't even start. Hang on, Spider Monkey.
Your assignment is to listen to The Buzz on Monday nights from 8 to 10 p.m. Central on ztalkradio.com. This message will self-destruct.
You're listening to Z-Talk Radio Network. The views expressed and opinions given by the individual hosts and their guests do not necessarily reflect those of Z-Talk Radio, its affiliates, or sponsors.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Paranormal Underground Radio on Z-Talk Radio. I'm Karen Fraser. With me, Rick Hale.
Hello.
Hello. And so now I'm so excited. We talked a little too long earlier, and I said we were wasting time. Clearly, that wasn't the case, but I wanted to talk to these two guys who are our guests. So tonight we're going to be talking to Kevin Manis and Jason Haxton. We've brought you the story of the Dybbuk box. I think this is probably our third or fourth time now, if you count the article in the magazine as well. And mm-hmm. the Dybbuk box tends to be somewhat of a dynamic story. So the original story actually starts with Kevin Manis, who is with us and who purchased it at an estate sale and had some strange happenings surrounding it. And then somebody else bought it between Kevin and Jason. And then Jason bought it. So, Kevin,
yeah.
Jason, I'm just going to set you aside for just a sec because I have to tell you, Kevin, we've all been trying to – oh, actually, Jason, you can join in on this too. We've all been trying to get a hold of Kevin for a long, long time. And as we were saying in the break, it appears that the Dybbuk box – does not want us to talk. What do you think about that?
I think that I'm usually a very, very easy person to get a hold of, and I return all my calls promptly when I get them. And, but there's something about circumstances that surround this little matter that either delay emails, turn phones off and on, things that go bump in the night, and for some reason I'm not as easy to get a hold of, I guess.
So do you really think that this, you know, simple-looking box has that kind of power, that kind of control?
No, I think it's a wine cabinet.
Okay, well, there you go. There you have it, ladies and gentlemen. Have a good night.
Here's the problem with my theory, though. And it's the problem that everybody seems to come up with, and that is the coincidence after coincidence after coincidence after coincidence that always points back to something about this stupid little cabinet. You get to the point where you just, no matter how rational and sane you are, you have to go, well, yeah, I guess, yeah, that does have something to do with it. Yeah. And then you find yourself kind of sitting and muttering in a corner somewhere and just wondering, yeah.
Yeah. So, Kevin, let's start real quickly with just if you could briefly talk about, because we've never heard your story firsthand. I've read it through your eBay listing and through what Jason's told me. But tell me about your experience with the Dybbuk box.
Well, it started off when I went to an estate sale and just basically bought what I refer to as a lot. I don't mean a bunch. I mean a lot, like an auction lot of items. And mm-hmm. one of the items that was included in this lot was this little wine cabinet. And at the time that I bought it, I had no need for it, didn't want it, and didn't realize that it had actually been included. But when I saw it, it occurred to me that it was, first of all, not in keeping with what I was really buying. And I was happy to give it back to the family, thinking maybe it was something that shouldn't have been in the first place. And I tried to do that and didn't have too much success with it. I talked to the granddaughter of the woman who had passed away, and she kind of described what it was to me. That's when she told me that it was, in fact, called the Dybbuk box. And I said, well, here, I don't want to take something that shouldn't have been included. Go ahead and have at it. She said, you bought it. You're keeping it. And I said, really, it doesn't matter to me. I don't want my money back. You know, just go ahead. And she became pretty emphatic. She became actually emotional. And I said, no, you made a deal. You're keeping it. It was odd. It was an odd little, you know, thing. But I'll tell you, right. in the scope of life, you know, a lot of odd things happen. I said, okay, whatever. And took the box and went back to my shop.
Now, I was going to say, Kevin, I've always been interested because how did this person, did you ever find out from this person how, a Dybbuk happened to be in this box, if there is, in fact, one?
If there is, in fact, one. And I don't know exactly if yes, to answer your question, I did go back and talk with another family member, and the story that she told me was that when they were in Poland, I guess around 1938,
mm-hmm.
It was a time when seances and things, they were in a Jewish ghetto, but apparently seances and things of the occult were considered stylish, and that sounds really, really odd for, you know, a ghetto environment, but they
right.
were interested in these things. And apparently, the group of women, including the woman who owned the box, would get together and have these seances where they would try to contact entities from the other side, so to speak. At one point, they apparently thought that they contacted an entity from the other side, and for a while had kind of an ongoing relationship, an ongoing conversation, if you will, back and forth when they did these seances.
Mm-hmm.
Somewhere along the line, they felt that, or I don't know, felt or had a conversation where this entity that they've been talking with tried to convince them to bring it over to this side, if that makes sense.
That makes perfect sense.
Mm-hmm. And I guess the way it was described to me, as time went on, this entity would do certain things psychologically. If they didn't make contact, it would do things. It knew how to address them in certain ways that would make them feel like they should have guilty or emotionally play upon them.
You know, like my mother, okay.
Exactly. Anyway.
Oh, he knows our mothers.
This is what was happening with the spirit, and so the spirit was pressuring them in whatever way I can't imagine, psychologically, though, during these seances, to be brought over to this side. And these women decided, okay, sure, we'll bring you over, and decided that when they did that, they would try to trap it.
Okay.
And when they did that, apparently, something went awry. And when I first went back and contacted the woman who was, there was a relative that had survived. She was a very little girl at the time, but she was there when this was all happening.
Mm-hmm.
She survived the camp. When I contacted her about this, she initially began telling me this by apologizing for World War II, for Korea, for Vietnam, for the Khmer Rouge, Pol Pot, and just a list of disaster after disaster after disaster that took place during the 20th century that she felt they were responsible for, because it was her belief that when they brought this thing over from the other side, they unleashed these terrible things upon humanity.
Huh.
See, what I want to know is, you say that they were doing spiritualist type, rituals and seances. Yeah. Now, if this being a Jewish community, do you think that this could actually been more of a Kabbalah thing?
No.
No?
Okay. No. If you had asked me this 7 or 8 years ago, I might not have known as much or been aware of as much as I am now, and I may have had a different answer, but no, I don't believe it was at all.
Okay.
And I'll tell you for a couple of reasons why. Number one, it doesn't seem that this group of women were as heavily Orthodox,
sure,
as perhaps would be the requirement for a practicing Kabbalah of that nature.
Right.
Yeah, because this is before Kabbalah was trendy.
Well, when was Kabbalah trendy? The 1200s?
Yeah. It's trendy now. It's trendy now.
It is trendy now.
I don't know.
Yeah.
But there's Kabbalah, then there's Kabbalah. You know, there's Kabbalah with a C, there's Kabbalah with a K.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I think that just given the fact, just because of the fact that they were Jewish, that they would have brought some of that to the table, don't get me wrong. However, I think that they were really trying to be hip and stylish and get their minds off of the death that was all around them in the ghetto at the time. This was an escape, if you will, of sorts. And I don't think they bargained for what they got. This is basically, I think they sat down to play a game of Ouija board, and it got a little crazy.
That's what it sounds like.
Yeah.
Wow. So you brought it home. You brought it to your shop, and a few things happened in the shop.
Yeah. And understand, when these things were happening, these are not the type of things that you think to yourself, oh my gosh, I have a haunted box.
Right.
They didn't start to make any sort of sense together for the longest time, up until the time I actually tried to sell it on eBay, really. When I first brought it back to the shop, I had taken it in, and my shop had a basement workshop. I had a retail area upstairs, and there was only one way in and out of the basement workshop. I took it down and put it in the basement and went on about doing my other daily affairs. And after I had left, I received a phone call from the girl who was managing my my retail floor, and she was hysterical and screaming that there was somebody in the basement who was tearing the place up, breaking glass, breaking light bulbs, swearing, and she was really afraid. And so was I have to tell you, because there was only one way in, only one way out. There hadn't been anybody there, which means somebody would have had to have spent the night there. And above and beyond all that, who in the heck is going to spend the night there and then get up and start, you know, causing this kind of chaos? So I made a beeline back to my shop. When I got there, the front gate, which was an iron gate with a huge heavy padlock, it was locked. And I opened the gate, came in, found my manager in my office, literally quivering in a corner. Went downstairs to see who was there, what was going on, and came down to find that all the lights had, in fact, been broken. There was nobody there. But all the light, the big, long fluorescent tubes had all been crashed, broken. All the incandescent bulbs had been broken. Things were strewn around. And there was an unmistakable scent of jasmine flowers. As you got to the bottom of the stairs, you could actually define the area where it was, like an invisible square. You could walk through it. Went back upstairs to find out, you know, what she could tell me, and she'd already left, and I didn't see her again for another 2 years. She never came back to work for me.
Wow.
No, that I think definitely something like that would scare the hell out of some people.
You know, it really, at the time, it didn't. At the time, I thought, you know, she's probably upset because I had taken off that morning and was going to, you know, leave her there and dump a lot of work. You don't equate something like this to, like I said, a haunted box. Because remember, at the time, I didn't think it was haunted. I thought it was a wine cabinet I bought, you know?
Right.
You know, I didn't come in and say immediately, oh my gosh, we've got a terrible furniture problem. I said, what the hell's going on?
Actually, Kevin, didn't you even think someone might have gone by, locked the door, was all upset, and that was her retribution to you, was for, you know, being locked in this place.
Exactly.
Even though, in hindsight, we realized, no, that wasn't what happened. But to you, it seemed rational. Well, maybe she just got pissed off at being locked in, and it wasn't seem like her nature, but she went downstairs and destroyed things.
Exactly,
know?
And that made perfect sense. Yes.
Except for her not coming back and not wanting to talk about it.
Right.
Well, that's because she's afraid she's going to go to jail.
Yeah.
So then, not knowing that the furniture then is what is wreaking this havoc in your basement, and are you convinced now that that's what happened, or do you still think there might be an alternative explanation?
Well, you know, I can't, as a rational sentient being, say, well, now, yes, I do believe something crawled out of that wine cabinet and broke all my light.
Right.
I mean, how do you say that? I don't know how to.
Right.
But I'll tell you this. I do know, or I have heard from people that I don't know, let's put it that way, from Jason, as a matter of fact, from the person that I sold the box to, from other people, that where this box goes, there is the unmistakable scent of alternating either jasmine flowers or cat piss, which I smelled on different occasions. Now, whether or not it should be attributed to this box or there's something along with it, I really don't know how to explain it other than, guess what? Yeah, I had that experience, and if you did too, when you had the box, well, okay, so be it. One or two people is not, you know, unusual. When you get to 8, when you get to 10,
And when you live in a house, for instance, the sense that I've had those, this is Jason, and smelled the jasmine and the cat piss in areas where it shouldn't be. But then also these exploding lights, you see, that, again, it's one thing to have a light go out. It's another thing to have them in multiples explode at you, and it's the scariest thing in the world. And
so has that happened to you too, Jason?
Oh, yeah. I mean, going down the hallway of my home, literally having bulbs explode and basically being lost in the dark. It's like, it's just freaky.
I do have a quick question about the smell of jasmine and the cat urine. Now, is there like a certain mood in the house? Like if everybody's happy, you smell jasmine, or if everybody is, you know, fighting and they're pissed off at each other, you smell the cat urine.
You know, for my part, let me just chime in and say my mood, anybody's mood around me had nothing to do with it. It was an independent thing, and I would say at that point, if it is attributable to the box was setting its own mood, but it had nothing to do with how we were.
Okay.
an accident. Right. Now, and with my ownership, one thing I did notice is the sense, having had it now for almost 7 years, it does seem like when it wants to appease you, it goes to this jasmine-y smell. It thinks that you like that, I think. And if it seems, whenever it's moved or whenever it seems like it's actually when it's being moved, it lets off this urine scent as if it's not pleased being shuffled around. And so the last time we sealed it in this arc of Acacia Wooden Gold, that was the last time it released an incredible urine stench. It was just fine. And all of a sudden, I'd just gotten back from the Amish, the Ark, it had all been ready. And I shoved it in, and my son was like, "Oh my gosh, Dad, can you smell that?" And it's like, "Smell what?" And the room just permeated with this piss. And we just shut the door and we're done with it. So it's pretty much stayed sealed since then.
Yeah. And it's last time I talked to you, Jason, it was in the museum. And now I seem to understand it's in the house.
It doesn't stay at the museum long because the staff doesn't like to have it there. That's for sure. And now I have to say that there is yet a third scent. And that is just its normal smell if you were just to open the doors. And it's a real addictive, almost heady, real woody smell. But still, you can't quite put your finger on it. And I had an Indian couple, an older couple, very mystic, stay because I know their son, and he's a brain surgeon from our medical school. He's married to a woman who's an oncologist for pediatrics. So she's a cancer, children's cancer doctor. And so, I mean, really a very intelligent, very wealthy family. They just came by and spent the night. When we opened up the doors, because they begged and begged and begged to see this thing, and he smelled it, the father of this brain surgeon. He runs up and gets his wife, who's in bed. She comes down in her sari with her red ruby. And he goes, "I want you to smell this thing and tell me what you think." And so we open the doors, and she goes, "Oh, my gosh, my mother could call summon spirits, and she would literally rub the palm of her hand and produce a white ash, and that was the exact scent." Weeks later, they wrote back and said, "This is the greatest honor to actually have seen this thing." And they thought it was a very big spiritual privilege. And I was really shocked. And that it seems to go through all kinds of cultures, not just the Jewish, but Wiccans, paranormal, all types of people. I had a NASA engineer measuring it and said, "What's coming out of the box is just the strongest energy from objects that he's ever seen." And this is a person who worked with NASA, and this is what his job was measuring with all these tools, the, you know, molecular structure almost. So it's interesting.
Now, let me proffer this at this point. This is Kevin again. At this point, if I were to chime in and say, you know, I don't think it has any value whatsoever, it's not haunted, would it really matter when you hear multiple stories like that are completely unassociated with me, on and on? Yeah, I mean, you know, it doesn't matter what I say.
Right. So when was it then that you actually began to put that connection together? Because I know you fixed it up and you gave it to your mom.
Well, I didn't really have to fix it up. It was in the shape it, you know, I think it's probably currently in. It's a pretty sturdy little box. I put some lemon oil on it, and and gave it to my mom for her birthday. And within a couple of minutes, 15, 20 minutes, I don't remember exactly, but she had a major stroke.
You attribute this to her having the box in her possession?
Not even close. No, she had a stroke. I just happened to have a box, the Dybbuk box, sitting beside her that I had just given her on October 31st. That's all. Yeah. And so she goes to the hospital, and I go to the hospital also, and it was interesting. Strokes affect different people differently. And in unimaginable ways. The way that this major stroke affected her was she started to lose her eyesight, but she also couldn't speak. Although, if you wrote something and put it in front of her, she could read it.
Okay.
Interestingly enough. So, she could print herself. She had, when I went to see her, sent me a note that said, I think it said, "No gift." At first, and I said, "Yeah, Mom, I got you a gift," thinking that she was talking about, you know, for her birthday, obviously. Mm-hmm. And she came back and said, "Hate gift."
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, you know, Mom, that's the least of our worries right now. You know, I'll get you two gifts if you just get better. And I said, don't worry about it. And it was odd, and I attributed that at that point just to the effects of the stroke. However, my mom is a somewhat, you know, she's a Jewish mother. She's a spiritual person. She has a direct contact to God. And I figured maybe there's something a little bit more to it. I'll tell you when it really hit home was during a conversation I was having with my brother and my sister and my sister-in-law. And one of us was talking about a dream that we had. I think it was my sister-in-law. And she described a dream that was absolutely identical to a dream that I had been having during the time that I had Fox as well. And when she did this, we were all in the room. My sister chimed in and said that she had been having it as well. And I called my girlfriend, who wasn't even present, and asked her if there was anything strange that she remembered about when she had had the box in her possession, and whether or not she had had any strange dreams. And she said, in fact, yes, she had, and described again the exact same dream as well. That's when things started. And if you don't know, if you're not familiar with what the dream was, let me tell you real briefly. The dream starts out the same way every time. I'm with somebody who is familiar to me, someone who I'm comfortable with, be a relative, a friend, whatever. Okay. And it's a very normal, serene setting. And at one point, I'll look at the person in my dream, make eye contact, and for just a split second, something in that eye contact changes, and you make the realization that who you're looking at, or who I'm looking at, is not who I'm looking at all. And at that point, whoever it is that I'm looking at morphs, basically, into this hideous hag who proceeds to just kick the living hell out of me. And literally, I mean, throw me around the room upside down, beat the hell out of me, to the extent that, and this is hard to even admit, but I've woken up with bruises. And this is exactly the same dream that they described, that my girlfriend described, and believe it or not, last time we did an interview, I think, with Mysterious Universe, we hadn't even brought this up. One of the moderators mentioned that he had been having a dream, described it, and described this dream exactly.
Wow.
See, now I wanted to ask you about that. You know, with the dream with the horrible hag. Have there been any real physical manifestations concerning with the Dybbuk? I mean, has anybody actually seen what the Dybbuk looks like?
You know, you have to say, are we saying that there is a Dybbuk, or is it just called the Dybbuk box? Who knows?
Well,
I think outside of this hag, I have not seen. And the other things that manifested during the time I had it, you know, in my possession.
Jason, have you had that dream too, Jason?
I've had similar dreams of hags. My hag basically is almost my hag is almost electric. I mean, just literally is almost blue static coming off. And when I woke from those dreams, my eyes, it looked like someone had just take their fingers and gouged them. And this is what a rabbi later said, that entrance of the spiritual into the body typically will come through the eyes. I mean, through the mouth, but if not the mouth, then through the eyes, and typically will cause damage. And I had a really severe vision loss for years. And as we've sealed it, it's come back to some degree. And I know Kevin's mother is probably almost blind now. She tells me she blames that damn box.
And one of the things that the relative profusely apologized for was the chemical accident that happened, I guess, in Bhopal, India, and that was an accident where 20,000 people lost their eyesight. That is a reoccurring theme also. We've done interviews, for instance, with Whitley Strieber, who had eyesight problems two weeks before his wife had a major stroke also.
Right. Oh,
and strokes.
Wow.
It's a combination of eye problems, blindness, and stroke seem to be how things are manifested. So.
And cyclones.
Wow. Well, bad weather. Yeah.
Yeah. So you know, Cheryl just reminded me of something, Jason. That when we did, a couple years that we've been talking to you about this now. And when we did that very first podcast with you, it used to not be a radio show. It was a podcast, and so I would edit it. And as I was editing that podcast, this strange voice came through in the middle of the podcast and said, "Boppy," and it wasn't any of us.
I remember that now from your, when you basically writing it online and stuff.
Yeah, we made a joke out of it, but Yeah.
What you don't realize is when you were just asking if the Divic box had trouble, you completely vanished. And yeah, Kevin noticed it too. And in the last interview we gave, the entire telephone system shut off in the building, no explanation, and then came back on. For a second, I didn't think I was going to, I mean, I was like, hello, where are you guys?
Oh, yeah.
But this is another problem. Never does an interview go where things don't go right. I mean, most of these people, like you guys, have perfect interviews. Never a trouble, but this is consistent. So,
We're sort of cursed in the interview department. We have problems all the time.
Yeah, so, like last week, my Skype kept going down and coming back and then going
Rick
down
kept
and coming
disappearing.
Back. Yeah.
Hello. So anyway, but as far as the, like manifestations or EVP, this is actually Leah Ramesses, who does Haunted Australia. She actually, very early on when I had it, would have these voices manifest because she was trying to connect, happening there. And as I was doing rituals on my end to take EVP, I thought, just to be safe, I better smoke a little sage around this box. And it was at that time being kept in a basement. Her entire house filled with sage. They thought it was on fire, and only to disperse. And it was just like, and you can go on their website and stuff, but it does seem to do strange things like that. Anybody that's connected to Kevin and I or the topic itself, it seems to like to have fun.
Kevin, I wanted to ask you something real quick. I wanted to go back to your shop that you had. The pictures that you guys sent over, I noticed something in one of the pictures that was, it could be a reflection and it might not be, because it's pretty well defined. But, and if anybody wants to go to the website, you can find it there. It's in the forum. And it's a picture of the front of your shop and the door shut and the grate is closed. Now, in the upper right-hand corner, you can actually see what looks like the very well-defined face and shoulders and part of the arm of a man.
Okay, where am I finding this now?
See, Kevin, I sent you that shot when I was last. Okay. Well, actually, I took pictures of Kevin at the shop and the gate without Kevin. And Kevin, I sent them an image for the site of just your gate so they could understand how that gate could have been locked. But Kevin, you had experiences of shooting images and what happened in your basement with the little minion. You might want to tell about that.
Let me just, I'm online right now. If somebody can shoot me that shot, that I can take a look at it
can you see the chat area that we have in Skype? Because we pasted it in Skype.
Let me see. The chat area of Skype. I believe I do have a chat. Oh, no, that's add people to this call. I don't want to get too technical here.
Yeah, no, we don't want to add anybody. Cheryl, can you send it? Can you send that link directly to Kevin, Cheryl?
Yeah, I'll shoot it over an email right now.
Good.
There, as I obviously I'm not familiar with anything standing out of a photograph that, otherwise I'd say, oh, yeah.
Gosh, I just noticed there's more to this photograph than just the guy's face.
What? And I sent the photograph, and I don't even know what you're talking about, because it was just a picture I took, and I thought, and I don't really study these things, and they're usually small, and so I just, you guys, you want to know what the shop looks like? Here it is. I'm even kind of freaked out, because it's I took the picture.
Do you see the face, Jason?
I like I said, I'm just right now on the side. I dare not touch anything for losing everybody. So
I get freaked out because I think I'm in the picture. Where's the picture?
Cheryl said she emailed you the link. You guess what? She can't connect to her email right now.
Of course she can't.
Oh, interesting.
Because whatever's in the picture does not want us to do anything with it. So, and so let's just say, Rick, you're seeing even more than you thought you saw.
Well, what I see, and if anybody else is able to see, and hopefully you gentlemen will be able to see it, it's not just the face, but if I look below the sign, it also looks like there's legs. So it could be that you guys actually caught a full-bodied apparition in this picture through the door.
Well, so Kevin, you own like antiques. Well, this says it's a chiropractic clinic.
Well, it's been changed. See, it closed down because of all this. Well, Kevin, tell what happened. I mean,
there's the which part? Yeah, it subsequently has become a chiropractic clinic, and we didn't end up closing down the the shop. I'm freaked out trying to find this picture on my email right now. Sorry, guys. What can I?
We're gonna go to break in about 8 minutes. We'll make sure you get it when we go to break.
I've ruined this whole show now, haven't I?
No, gosh, oh heavens, no.
Okay, moving back though, let's just say what ended up happening is after his mother had a stroke, his entire business was almost as if the Nazis came. I mean, they literally came through, took everything and everything electronic.
Let me give you a little bit better idea what happened. At the time that my mother was having a stroke, exactly the same time. On my retail floor. My mother had been upstairs on the retail floor also. And I asked the guy who was my foreman at the time to ask them to leave so that we could close it down because I was on the phone with the ambulance calling for to come and get my mother. He did this, and at the time, we were shocked when they turned around and produced FBI badges and said, no, we're not going anywhere. And at that point, there were representatives from the FBI, the Portland Police, the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office, who my uncle was the sheriff at the time, and probably 10 or 15 other local, regional, and federal law enforcement agencies that came streaming through our doors, took control of the premises, and proceeded to execute a major search. For what? We never found out. I was never told. They took everything in my shop that had an electronic chip or a memory chip in it, and charged no one, arrested no one. As a matter of fact, it encouraged me to leave immediately and go and, you know, with my mom to the hospital. And when I got back, I had a note from my my landlord saying, "Well, this kind of puts a damper on things. You're out of here." But never returned the items that they absconded with for a little over a year. At which time they had a beautiful FBI agent, as I recall, come out, give me all the stuff back and say, "Oh, sorry about that. Thanks, bye."
Oh.
You know, I've actually heard about stuff like that happening before where their intel is wrong, they get the wrong address, and then they're rushing in looking for, you know, 50 tons of meth or crack or whatever.
It's still an odd coincidence.
Literally. On exactly the same day at exactly the same hour. Yeah, and we're not talking about a small little, "Hey, we want to talk to you." We're talking about literally 150, 200 law enforcement officers. They closed down the major gateway into the city and came through and did that. And still to this day, I don't have an explanation as to why.
And so Kevin's shop remained empty for really quite a while, and then it was just absorbed into the chiropractic school that's there. So,
okay. All right, and this is in downtown Portland, right?
The heart of, yes.
Yes, yes, I'm your neighbor to the north. I'm not far from you, so I'm up in Washington State.
And a wonderful state.
Yes, yes. Well, I like to come down there because I like the wine.
And we like it when you come.
That's right. Kevin, no sales tax.
Yeah,
Kevin, why don't you share with them though, when you're away from your shop for a little bit, what the locals have been saying about what was going on in your basement?
If you're familiar with downtown Portland at all, you know that Burnside is not only the beautiful gates to our lovely city, but also an area that for quite a long time has been a little less than upscale. Let's put it this way. A lot of the guys who drink a little bit too much would hang out there. And we had, when I first opened the shop, we had some guys that would show up right outside the shop like clockwork. If they'd been employees, they would have been the best employees I ever had. Every single day, show up with a bottle of Night Train or Mad Dog and stay there throughout the day, at which time, you know, they would at 5:30 leave, go home, wherever they went. And I got down there one day and ran into a couple of them who said, they started going off about what had been going on in the shop actually the night before. And I said, "You know, what are you talking about? There was nobody here the night before." And not to get too detailed, but they described things that they saw in the basement that were just bizarre. I mean, people dancing, and again, there's no way into this basement except for the front door to the shop, and the front door to the shop had been absolutely padlocked and locked for the entire night. This gets into an area also that, you know, if anybody listens to what I have to say and says, "Oh, you know, he's kind of full of crap," this is stuff that's documented. You know, these are things apparently these guys witnessed things that were, you know, policemen would come by and look in and say, "Okay, there's something weird going on." But you can't have 150 or 200 officers stream through your door and do that kind of a search or execute that kind of a warrant without it being heavily documented also, along with my mom's hospital records and everything like that. So.
And there are windows, so you could actually look into the basement from barred windows.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Now, I have a question about a Dybbuk in and of itself. Every you know, ancient culture has, you know, like a nature spirit or an elemental, you know, the fae and hungry ghosts and the Mara or whatever. Now, when it comes to the Dybbuk, I've actually heard various different things about a Dybbuk, that this is actually a nature spirit that is neither good nor evil, sort of stays neutral, or that it's a human spirit that is somehow, you know, after dying, you know, has to work off some kind of a debt. Now, do you guys, you know, have any idea what this, you know, Dybbuk is? That is it the spirit of an elemental or of a dead person?
You know, my take on that might be a little bit different. I only have the information that I grew up with, you know, as a kid, and that was that a Dybbuk was a soul that had passed on, that had come back basically to live vicariously by cleaving onto another person's living soul.
Right.
And as far as good or bad, yeah, Dybbuk was not ever considered anywhere I went or heard as being a good thing. This is right. An entity that came back that would do bad things through a good living person.
Okay.
Not that it had to do anything to work off any debt or anything either. It's just, you know, some people are Dybbuk, some people aren't, I guess.
Okay.
Well, and of course, one of the things that Kevin told me in visiting with the family, that after they, you know, this box was a personal possession, was to be buried with this woman. She assumed everything would be going fine, dies, and then the box isn't buried with her. And I think Kevin had mentioned to me that the family said, well, because of their action of selling it, they actually set this thing into motion, and that it kind of had a journey to go on, and they weren't really sure what the journey was, but something that might have been very personal with this relationship with Havila, who had this for years. And my thought is that each person that it basically gave trouble to, including myself, was to instigate us to figure out what it was. And in the book, actually, there is a strange journey, and this thing comes to a town in the middle of the Midwest, a town of 17,000 that certainly could have nothing to do with the Holocaust. And yet, it basically, I do think the unfinished business was to point a finger at wrongdoing in America that really dealt with what ended up happening to a lot of the Jewish people. And now that it's kind of come full circle, I do think it can rest. However, I also believe that if someone were to get this item out and actually wish and pray and hope for something, they would set it back into motion again, and it would go on yet another journey of truth finding. That's my belief. Wow. Read the book.
Well, you know, and something else I do want to bring up also as far as the independent nature of this thing, because it does have some qualities that are unique in that sense. There have been deaths that are associated with this box, not just with me, but other people as well. The one that was associated, as far as I'm concerned, with me, with this, was an incident that took place in my shop where a guy that worked for me, his brother, had been in prison and was released and came down to the shop to find his brother, and his brother wasn't there. And when I told him that his brother wasn't there, the guy just snapped and started goose-stepping around the retail floor and saying Sieg Heil and doing a bunch of Nazi stuff. And basically lunged at one point, and when he lunged, he hit the box and knocked it over.
Mm-hmm.
The following morning, they found this kid across the river, right directly across the bridge, the Burnside Bridge, on 2nd, with his own belt wrapped around his neck, and he was dead, and the police labeled it as a suicide.
Whoa.
See, now that's kind of what we were talking about before we actually had you guys come on, you know, unleashing the Dybbuk box upon, you know, a bunch of scumbag neo-Nazis. I mean, it sounds like that it may have actually done something of that nature.
It was a very, again, odd coincidence, you know. I mean, you know, maybe the guy was going to be found with his own belt wrapped around his neck anyway, but...
Sure. Well, and here's the thing. You bring up a good point, Rick. In my research of just looking for... A lot of people know about this thing, and there are these supremacist websites with names like Stormfront and all these things.
Right.
They they fear this thing. Oddly enough, it's like they want to have nothing to do with it. And it's like, again, not even curious about it. It's just plain fear. And it's like, these are guys that don't fear anything from my perspective. But yeah. this thing does kind of throw a chill into them. So I think that's kind of interesting.
Actually, I disagree. I believe they fear everything. And that's why they are the way they are.
I agree.
Yeah.
You know what? Hey, guys, we need to take a quick break, but when we come back, I want to talk, we want to talk to you guys about the items that are inside the Dybbuk box and the Shema, which is written on the side, I believe.
Right on the back side.
Okay. Yeah, so if we can take a quick break, and then when we come back, we'll talk some more about the Dybbuk box. Throw it over to Cheryl.
Hi, everyone. It's Karen Frazier at Paranormal Underground.
And I'm Rick Hale, Paranormal Underground writer.
We're here to invite you to explore the unexplained with Paranormal Underground Radio, live and on the air.
Join us every Thursday night for paranormal talk and great guests from 9 to 11 p.m. Eastern Time on ztalkradio.com.
Hi, I'm Chad Wilson, publisher and co-founder of Paranormal Underground Magazine.
And I'm Cheryl Knight, editor-in-chief and co-founder of Paranormal Underground Magazine.
Every month, Paranormal Underground explores the unexplained with a free monthly online magazine.
We take an in-depth look at all kinds of unexplained phenomena, talk with some of the field's top experts, and share the latest news and information about the paranormal.
Visit us at ParanormalUnderground.net, where you can read the magazine online, explore our paranormal evidence galleries, watch videos, participate in discussions, or read blogs with some of our writers and editors.
We hope you'll join us. Visit ParanormalUnderground.net and explore the unexplained.
Hi, this is Karen Frazier, author of Avalanche of Spirits, The Ghosts of Wellington, a new book from Ghost Night Media. In summer of 2009, I visited Wellington, Washington, a former railroad town in the Cascade Mountains of Washington State, where the worst avalanche disaster in the history of the United States occurred. 96 people lost their lives. What I found there changed my life forever. Before I visited Wellington, I wasn't sure that I believed in ghosts or even in the human soul. Now I know for sure that ghosts are real and that our souls go on after we die. You can read all about my experiences at Wellington in my new book, Avalanche of Spirits, The Ghosts of Wellington, which is on sale at Amazon.com. To learn more, visit avalancheofspirits.com. Do you want to keep up with what's going on at Paranormal Underground?
Then tweet us on Twitter at ParanormalUG.
Or follow us on Facebook at Paranormal Underground.
Meet us on MySpace, Paranormal Underground.
There's no need to be in the dark about what's going on at Paranormal Underground. Join us on your favorite social networking site today.
Hi, this is Nick Redfern, and you're listening to Paranormal Underground Radio on ZTalk Radio.
Hey, everybody, and welcome back to Paranormal Underground Radio at ztalkradio.com. We are your hosts, Karen and Rick, and we are here tonight with Jason Haxton and Kevin Manis, and we are talking the Dybbuk box, a highly controversial piece of furniture. It's a wine box that may or may not actually hold what is known as a Dybbuk, the spirit of a dead person who likes doing naughty things. So welcome back, guys.
It's good to be back.
Thank you.
Yeah, and that's dybbukbox.com for anybody who wants to go check out the story while they're listening. dibbukbox.com.
Cool. Now I really wanted to talk about what is inside the box, but first something that's outside of the box. Now I'm not of the Jewish faith, so I'm not familiar with it, but I know Kevin that you are. There seems to be what looks like a prayer. Mm-hmm. Or several lines of script written on the back. Can you tell us the significance of that and why it would even be on here?
Well, the prayer itself is a prayer that that most Jewish people are taught. The first prayer you ever learn and probably the last prayer you ever say is called the Shema. And in Hebrew, it goes like this: Shema Yisrael Adonai Eloheinu Adonai Echad Baruch Shem Kavod Makoto Le'olam Vayad. The translation of which is, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Praise be his name and his glorious kingdom forever." It's very simple.
Mm-hmm.
That is what is carved on the back of the Dybbuk box.
So could that be a protection against what is, supposedly in there?
It could be. It's the most basic thought, the most basic prayer that that you know as a Jew. You say it when something good happens, when something bad happens. You say it just when you realize that you haven't said it for a while. You say it a lot.
Sure.
And it's a basic thanks to God for being alive,
Okay. All right.
So, it's not just from what I'm looking at and what I've seen on the pictures. It's not just, you open it up and it's an empty box. There are actually some items that are in it. And, I kind of wanted to focus on that a little bit. You got the cup, and I believe there's the candle, but there's also a clump of hair in there, correct?
Two clumps.
Okay, two clumps of hair. What is the, why would there be human hair in there?
Well, in ritual, I guess hair has been used, for thousands of years as a sacrifice. Mm-hmm. It also can be used as a memory of a person. I mean, it's your DNA, it's you. And so, again, why specifically these pieces? But in olden Jewish times, you would actually braid your hair and cut it and give it. That is now transcended into what is now braided bread. That is used as part of a worship, kind of remembering the old days of when you just cut off a hunk of your hair and stuck it out there as a sacrifice. So hair is very ritual, and it's very much you.
Yeah.
Okay, that makes sense.
What about the wine cup? The little, what's that? Is it a little gold wine cup?
Kevin, yeah.
Well, it was a little silver chalice. It could be a little chalice. It also, in a pinch, could be used as a soft boiled egg, holder. Mm-hmm. It looks like to me also. It's really difficult to ascribe what the meaning of these different things. Look, there was a candlestick with octopus legs. What do you do with that?
Right.
I mean, this
like
is
it's got
really
Cthulhu written on it or something. You know?
Right.
I'm sorry.
I was gonna say,
it was a bizarre little candlestick that looked like it was going to get up and run away, and it's sitting on these octopus, and an octopus has eight legs. This one, I believe, had four. I don't know what the heck. And two pennies from the 1920s, mm-hmm. A couple of dried rosebuds. Are these the things that you use to entice a spirit? Are these the things that you use when you are doing something else that has nothing to do with that, and you figure, I'll do this ritual too, what the heck? Who knows?
Well, in the octopus, of course, the sea is always mysterious, and it's the, is it the K'Chithul or whatever, there is this occult of the octopus creature from Lovecraft and the ocean. And so, of course, the ocean is always mysterious. So certainly it's an unusual candlestick, because actually trying to find those, they do exist. They're from about the 1890s, but they're very difficult to find. And this one is actually burned so that the legs actually have come back on themselves, except the wood itself, there's no harm to it. So it was obviously in an intense heat, and yet didn't burn, which is kind of strange. The granite stone, actually, in itself, the way it's weighted, and of course, granite can hold electricity, can hold energy, almost like a quartz. Granite is quartz, like a quartz watch. It is actually created in such a way that it wants to fall over. There's kinetic energy. So if there were a battery in it, running it, it would be that granite piece, which has shalom, which I've been told by Rabbi Goldstein, a woman who's worked with me on this, that is a piece, but it's kind of almost a piece that is almost unattainable when you think of the true shalom. It's almost like death.
Right.
So...
You guys probably won't be surprised to hear, but Rick actually dropped off the call.
His little phone sitting there hung up.
That's right. So hopefully we'll get him back.
You guys are just doing this to make us feel at home, aren't you?
Yeah, really. That's our whole goal, is to make you feel at home. You know, so I have to tell you, I've always been very drawn to this story. And that's something that seems to happen, right, Jason, that people are very drawn to the box and the story.
Thousands of people feel very connected. Even those that bid against me to own the box, because it was a public auction. Anybody could have gotten it. And a woman that didn't said that after she lost it, her computer fouled up and she couldn't bid. It prevented her from bidding, and she had the money, she had the desire, and after it was done, she had such a loss, she kept hunting on the web to see if she could find this, and eventually found the listing and felt reconnected. It's just kind of interesting.
And have you ever sold anything on eBay, either of you?
Oh yeah, I have. Yeah, well, Rick's not here, so, but okay. I have.
when you sell something on eBay, would it be strange, for instance, 7 or 8 months later, to have somebody call you or get on an email and say, by the way, you know, about that mixer that you sold, what's going on with that?
Yeah.
People actually do, and Jason has really hit it on the head. There is a connection that can't be described, and I'll tell you what else is really interesting about the story that is unique to the story, and that is, there are going to be people who listen to the show and who say, well, Jason's full of crap or Kevin's full of crap. They're all full of crap. And they're going to go to the website and they'll look it up. And as they look, they'll realize that everything is happening in real time. That the reports that are coming up on the internet are not things that happened 10 years ago to your brother's cousin's son, you know, whatever. These are things that are happening to people like Jason, people like me, who you can talk to directly. And things that are happening right now, and somewhere along the line, what invariably happens is they make a connection for themselves, and then it's not somebody else's story, it's theirs.
Yeah.
And that's what's really weird. And you know what? It can be good, it can be bad, but they're in it.
Yeah, well, and it, you know, it has the feel of urban legends. So that's just trying to connect with Rick again, that ringing. Oh, are you there? Oh. Did it work?
Yeah, it worked.
Yay, okay.
Okay, I'm going to be superstitious here for just 2 seconds. You guys have to excuse me because I am Irish-American, so I'm allowed to be superstitious, okay? I did not mock this thing, right?
No. You've been very respectful. So anyway, what I was saying is it has the feel of urban legend, and actually Jason just did an interview with me for Love to Know Paranormal, which isn't up yet, but it will be within the next day or so. And that's actually how I started out the article, is that it feels like an urban legend, but it's not, you know? And
well, most
people
urban
like
legends, you have to kind of try and track people down, or you can never get to the root of them.
Right.
It's kind of like in Spaceballs, where he was like, you know, your cousin's brother's sister's uncle's great uncle was my former roommate. That's almost what urban legends are like.
Yeah, but this one's not.
Right.
No, it happened to me. It happened to Jason, and
it's still happening.
It's still happening. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so Jason, when in the interview that I did with you with Love to Know, you seem to indicate that you feel that the box might be resting.
I do, and that's what I'm saying is through the book and meeting people like Kevin, talking with his mother, visiting with a bunch of paranormal people, and really rabbis and Kabbalists and scientists have really come. And that's what the book is about, is this journey of 7 years where I really feel that it had a mission, which it's achieved in kind of outing a very evil person. The person didn't start off being evil. They wanted to be helpful, but right. But good things can go very bad. And so what I'm saying is I do truly believe that whatever was its initial mission, it's done. So until it's requested to go and do more, it's happy just to be where it's at, just giving off its nice scent. And not plaguing me, my family, or it does little things, but again, it's more just kind of like, you know, resting. And right. When I've asked my son, I said, look, so people say, well, what are you going to do with it? It's like, well, I actually think I wouldn't mind being buried with it. Unfortunately, that requires your family, kind of like what happened the first time with this thing. Right. They basically do this. In talking to my son, I said, well, would you have any issue with that? He's 20 years old. And, he said, no, I don't want to bury with you for fear. What if something goes wrong? And then it haunts me, and then it's stuck with you, and I'm now, you know, in this dilemma. And he goes, I'd rather not bury with you at all. And it's like, well, wait a minute. You know, so then what do you do with the thing?
Right. I guess you leave it in its little ark and hope it stays happy.
What about the idea of Dybbuk's in space?
Yeah, there you go. So, Jason, I know that the last time we talked, and I won't specifically mention names, but I know that the last time we talked, you had a co-author, and yet your name is the only name on the book. Can you talk about that at all?
Yeah, I can. I won't mention this person, but he has been on your show and has been on the show with me. And so you guys can just go do your research. But what happened with this author, and he's really well known for shadow people, and he's stayed in every haunted place in Missouri and wrote a real nice paranormal book on that. And what I thought was, well, great, this guy can write. I've got the research. We'll put this together and come out with a book. And he did too. He's like, yeah, let's get on this. So he comes to my house. He spends one night kind of with the box. And by morning, he is absolutely ill to a degree that his head is splitting. His back feels like it's broken. He can barely even get back home, which is 3 hours away. And all of a sudden starts picking up these scents, these paranormal shadows, these things. His family starts to be affected. He takes a few files home because he's obviously going to research and write. Within a week or so of staying with me, it is so bad that he basically just has to quit. And he said he apologized, and it's just, I cannot do this thing. And to this day, really will not talk about it, and does not, because he feels that anything he does with this item connects him, and he does not want to be connected, especially when his own son was basically showing these signs of kind of an oppression. His son could not get this foul odor out of his mouth, as he had it also, and it was spitting constantly. And so once he realized it was affecting his family, it's just like, okay, that's it. My wife has seen a psychological change in me. My kid is acting possessed. I'm done with it. And so as soon as he shipped things back and stopped, everything went away. And he said, and that's the way I want it.
And he was pumped to write the book, too.
Oh, yeah. This is an income. He doesn't make that much money. And so this was a potential source of revenue. And also to do what he does best. A journalist who writes these horror stories and investigates. And as he says, a lot of it's crap. I go in. I stay in the hotel room. Mm. There's a bad stain on the wall. I guess that's supposed to be the ghost. And yeah.
Right.
This is nothing. And he said this was the closest he's come to something real, and he doesn't want to. He only writes about family now. To my knowledge, he hasn't even written anything in the paranormal since a year ago. And this actually all happened. It actually was this time of the year. It was July. He stayed with me. I think it was like right after the 4th of July. And by August, it was done.
Yeah, so you were on our very first show that we had, the live show.
So it would have been a year ago, yeah.
So it was, and that was on June 1st, was our very, July 1st, June 1st, Rick?
July 1st was our first show.
It was July 1st, and he was getting ready to come stay with you at the time.
Yeah, and within the month, he was done with it, and to this day, really doesn't want to communicate with me, and he's a nice guy, and I'm sorry.
Well, you know, but there is, it's funny, the idea that this little wine cabinet created by a Jewish lady, over where it was created, brought over here to me and then to you in the middle of Missouri as a Methodist is an unlikely scenario, and yet it did take place. And it reminds me, though, of another story where God comes to Moses and says, here, I want you to do this. And Moses says, why me? You know, who am I to do it? Jason, it's kind of the same thing with you. You had a couple of different authors, haven't you, or writers that were going to come in and help you. But, you know, Jason, it becomes kind of apparent after the fourth or fifth one that this was for you to do. And I got to tell you, knowing you the way I do, nobody would have done a better job simply because you've been so impartial and yet so dedicated to it the entire time.
And it would, and I have to be honest, it would have been a very different book. It would have been a book told from a journalist investigating, right, as opposed to, really, it's just my tale, and it includes all the people, including the journalists, the rabbis, the Wiccans, the scientists. That's what makes it a great story, was everybody just gets kind of globbed into it. Hollywood. I mean, who would have thought that they'd spend $12.5 million. The film is done. They're just doing the edits. And it's coming out in January. And it's got people like Kevin Bacon's wife, Kyra Sedgwick. It's got, Jeffrey D. Morgan in it. It's got Midas Yahu, who's, you know, this Jewish rapper. I mean, all of a sudden, all these people are sucked in this little thing. And what I'm saying is, you would have to think it would be impossible. And when they called and wanted to do this, I told them, go away and leave me alone. And they wouldn't. Yeah.
You know, I think when you first called me, Jason, after you got a hold of it, you first called me, I hung up on you. It was, I mean, what are you talking about? You wanted to talk about a box?
So, you know, it's got a strange power.
with the movie, though, I mean, this isn't like what the treatment Hollywood gave the Connecticut thing with the Snedekers. Do they actually, you know, try to maintain the integrity of the story behind the Dybbuk box, or do they mess it up?
I seriously think that they didn't tell the story the way it was, but they tell of a feeling and things and of a culture and the Hasidic culture. And I think they in that sense get it right. And it is creepy. And mm-hmm. it does build like the box tends to do. And you do really want to, like me, solve it and be done with it.
So they capture the essence of the box as opposed to
the real story.
I got it. So I do see, I'm sitting here on IMDb, and I do notice that the number one writer credit is one Kevin Manis.
Really?
Yes, that's what it says. Writers, Kevin Manis.
And I think that's because of the eBay listing that they used for a lot of the story.
Yeah.
You got a small piece of the American dream, dude. Your name is in a major motion picture.
Well, that's fantastic. Let's do some more.
You are immortal now.
Next thing you know, you're going to be dating Lindsay Lohan.
No, I have to be honest, though. Kevin really, and like me, when they called and I said, you know what? Thanks, but no thanks. This is a hobby. And to some degree, they made me an offer. It wasn't a money offer. It actually was really a psychological issue. And kind of like the box, they knew how to play on me of my worst fears. And that's how they got me to agree. Kevin actually didn't agree to it for almost like four or five months. Really, I don't think, again, wanted to go this way. His mother did not want this to happen. It is not a direction. That's what I'm saying is everything to prevent it was out there. And you would think that, you know, how it ends up getting out there anyway is just like I said, we have no control over it. Mm-hmm. It will do what it wants to do. Well, and it wants to be known.
In order to really effectively tell this story from beginning to end, you have to necessarily start with people who were killed in a genocide. You have to start with these people who did not make it out of the ghetto alive, where this thing began. And in that regard, to disrespect or to not have the greatest amount of respect for them and their families is adding insult to injury as far as I'm concerned. And so if I Absolutely. Ever, if I see or if I felt that that were ever to be the case, I would do everything in my power to stop it, including stopping any movies or media of any kind, simply Certainly. Because
yeah,
that's
absolutely.
A paramount issue. And I really feel that this box, if it did have a mission, if it does have a place, that it's directly related in some way to dredging the whole idea of genocide and man's inhumanity. I don't mean to get way esoteric here, but man's inhumanity to man.
Right.
And bringing it to the forefront. I think that at least it's changed my life in that way. I think that before, I'll tell you, I know, before I ever got involved with this or had the box, my understanding of these things was minuscule, and now I'm actually, I feel like I'm committed to being a steward in that regard.
Wow. No, so that's a positive thing that has come out of this in spite of everything that's happened with your mother and your shop and everything else. That's something that's positive, wouldn't you say?
I don't know.
It's kind of like, Joe, it's kind of like, what? Yeah, but I have to do it that way. It's like,
well, yeah. It says there's a passage in Psalms, which I also didn't know until I got involved with this, but, you know, it says ignorance is bliss. Right after that, the line is knowledge is sorrow.
And, maybe
it is a good thing, maybe it's not. I tell you, I could have gotten through all these 7 years without the knowledge that I now have of what actually took place during World War II, what's taking place in Darfur, and the things that we need to be vigilant and constantly on guard to protect ourselves against. Yeah.
But somebody has to be vigilant about those things.
And me, so why not? So why me?
So I was just to say, Moses, why not you? You
know? Yeah, sure.
I kind of think in a way that the Dybbuk box is kind of a reminder of that time. You know, that, you know, it's like they had very little to do, and, you know, constantly afraid for their lives, and, you know, so maybe the Dybbuk box isn't really a bad thing after all.
I have this feeling that it is. Things that have bad happen, but things happen bad every day. But I do think it is more of a spiritual lesson. And I certainly have grown, I think, by getting involved with Kevin, getting involved with all these people. It really has raised my level of appreciation of the life we have here, but what's going to come. And I have to say, I think I was pretty much thinking, you know, it's a great life, and then you die and it's black, and that's not too bad either. This spiritual journey of learning and working and talking to people, I have to say, I look forward to the next life. I mean, because I really believe there is more. And that's quite a change in a person in 7 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Definitely. Well, maybe. And not to get too philosophical, but the other thing is that there's something to be said for the bitter with the sweet. And you don't appreciate the sweet unless you have the bitter. And so, you know, sometimes these life-changing experiences that really suck make everything else so much sweeter too, and including what comes after it.
Maybe we're just saying these things so we don't have really bad nightmares tonight.
You know what, guys, I gotta go to work as soon as I get off this show, so I ain't gonna be sleeping until at least tomorrow afternoon.
Yeah, he's not having nightmares. It'll be me. But I have nightmares a lot anyway, so there you go.
Yeah.
Well, the movie isn't called The Dybbuk Box. Is this still the movie? Is Sam Raimi, is he involved in this movie still somehow? Is that the same one, Jason?
Right. I mean, it's actually a Danish director, but it's under the auspices of Raimi's, I think, control, you know, as far as his group and things through Ghost House Pictures and Mandate. And so in that sense, it's called The Possession. And I think it's going to be really, like I said, I think it'll be a good movie. And I think it's got a great director. It's got a great cast. I've read the script. And I think, again, overall, I think it's going to be a lot of interest in January. And the Dybbuk box is identified, I believe, in the script in the movie. It's just not being called that right now.
Oh, so it's not actually being called, but it's called the Dybbuk box in the movie, the box that the young girl buys.
In the script, they identify it as a Dybbuk box. So I don't, since it was already filmed in March, and I assume that's done. So.
Yeah.
So how did you guys get, how did they get in touch with you? Just like, hey, we're really interested in this strange little artifact and we want to make a movie out of it. Who contacted you and how?
You know, let me start here for a second because I have a unique perspective, Jason. Jason is a very, very aggressive guy at times. he can find things in people, and I got to tell you, at the time that he initially contacted me, I really didn't want to have anything to do with this. But Jason initially contacted me and said, "Listen, man, we're not trying to make movies or anything. I just want the rest of the story. I just need to fill in the gaps here." And it was shortly thereafter that I did a small interview that started people calling me, and then. There. I didn't mean to interrupt you, Jason, but that was...
No, but that's true, because there actually was a freelance writer, Leslie Gornstein, and she was trying to get her break with the LA Times through some articles, and she saw this story or heard about it through the auction and begged and begged and said, "Fine, okay, you can do the story." And she put it in the LA Times, and they went to her. But then, because I wasn't... Actually, the website doesn't identify me, at least initially, ever at all. And so... she had to call me to give them to get permission for them to call me. So really, we're pretty well isolated and wouldn't have really been bothered by them except through her. And and they just made it clear this would become a movie. They then hired three different screenplay writers and had two different screenplays written that weren't good enough before they landed the third. They have worked on this for 7 years. Talk okay. about obsessed.
Yeah.
It is strange. It is strange that they, you know, this is a place that gives up on ideas right and left all the time, that they would pay and pay and pay to get this right, person after person. Mm-hmm. It's just odd. It's completely odd.
Yeah. You know, what's funny is how I actually originally came across you, and this was back when you didn't really necessarily want to be identified. I think, as a matter of fact, on our first show, the podcast that we did with you, you just came on as Jason. I don't think we said your last name at the time because you were still really hesitant about getting much attention. But I actually was doing a search for something called Frank's Box, which is a little ghost hunting device, yeah. for an article, and... in the midst of this research, just the word box brought me to the Dybbuk box. I mean, and that was how I found you, but I wasn't looking for anything like this. I was just looking for a little thing on a piece of equipment, and I found this great big huge story of the Dybbuk box, and I said it to Cheryl, and I said, "We got to talk to this guy." So I was really gratified that you actually got back in touch with me when I emailed you through the website, because you weren't exactly easy to find either. So.
Has anybody ever thought of bringing one of those Frank's boxes together with the Dybbuk box? I've always wanted to know if anything would come of that.
Frank's box meets Dybbuk box.
Well, isn't the Frank's box, isn't that like a multi-frequency switcher that is used to, am I off? Is that not right?
It's a radio. It's a radio that scans stations. And
exactly,
and,
yeah. Yeah, yep. Mm-hmm. I think communication through, yeah.
Well, the closest thing is this Melvin Vagel, who is a former engineer for NASA, who basically retired now and creates his own crystal arcs. And when he found out, it was just really weird. I was on a plane flying from visiting my mom about a year ago. It all happened at the same time. And his son happened to be sitting next to me. And I forget, you're chatting about this or that. And he's like, "So what are you writing about?" I said, "Oh, it's kind of stupid. And it's kind of like an arc thing." He goes, "Oh, my dad's into that." It's like, "You okay?" So I told him the story about that. Yeah, I'll never hear from him. He tells his dad. His dad finds me. His dad actually is up in Iowa. And we get together, and he's seen it several times and has done these scanning and measurements. And all these numbers and things go nuts. Mm-hmm. I don't understand it, but he seems to get very, very excited because he tries to create things like the Dybbuk box and fails. But then he sees the Dybbuk box and knows it's possible. You know?
So. Wow.
Well, I just think it's amazing that the thing actually gets the thumbs up by a former NASA scientist.
Yeah, Melvin Vagel, he's a cool guy. He can probably, I don't know if he's on the internet or whatever, probably doesn't like me shoot his name out there, but I thought, what the heck? It's the truth.
I think you'll find that most of the people that are involved in the serious research, and not me included, of course, but people that are involved and people who are associated with Jason are serious academians.
Yeah.
And we're not talking about a bunch of fringe, you know.
They're professors of history who study Greek mythology and Greek folklore and Greek artifacts, you know, anthropology.
Not necessarily even paranormal researchers, actual strict scientists, yeah.
Physicists.
Yeah. Well, Jason, you're no slouch yourself. You know, you've got some decent credentials too, so.
Because I'm always at universities, you can just keep going to school for free.
Hey, I'm in the wrong line of work. That's it.
Did you guys ever bring like any serious parapsychologists around, you know, like Lloyd Auerbach or William Roll?
I didn't. I just wanted to get rid of the damn thing.
I live in the middle of Missouri. It's like, again, people have begged for it, but again, it's kind of like the thing. Kevin's mother did warn me of one thing, and she goes, don't let loose of this thing. It could be bad. As mm-hmm. I was bad enough. And of course, that's why I hunted down Kevin. Really, it really was just to figure out why my life was going to hell in a handbag. And if anybody could empathize, he could. And really, that was the impetus for hunting him down, was to figure this out and get this thing, either find the woman and put it back where it belonged in the ground or whatever. But that was my sole reason for taking a year to hunt him, to see basically, and then finally meet him, was just to get this thing off my back. And but a lot of people in the process have bit by bit found me. And I feel this is, I don't lie about it. And it's something for everyone. I don't try to keep people away from it. If they have a sincere interest, I try to be accommodating.
Are people more afraid to approach this and be around it, or are they more interested, or is it a combination?
I find it a combination. Yeah.
Yeah, there are people who are actually there are people who are so terrified of the entire concept they don't want to brought up on their computer, they don't want to talk or hear about it, nothing. And then there are other people who have some interest. I don't think anybody is outwardly, you know, wants to sit down and have a drink with the box, but I mean, there are some people who are I would say even more than terrified. They don't want to, and I've never really understood why, because you know it freaks me out a little bit, but I've never had a terror. I don't think, and I've seen people that have, and it's.
I find people want power. People want to know the unknown, which I think is a source of power. I've got a counseling background, and to be perfectly honest, that's not a big issue with me. As a matter of fact, the more you try to give it away, that's why when Hollywood called, it's like, thanks, but no thanks. I got a great life, got a great family, have no interest in this. Again, the people that are sometimes drawn to it scare me. And so maybe it's best that I'm really pretty happy-go-lucky about it. Yeah, if it works out, fine. Yeah. If it doesn't. Again, I feel I have created a good life, and that's my focus. This is extra stuff, other stuff.
So do you think, though, that you are – and this is a really esoteric question that you probably can't answer except from your gut. Do you think that you were meant to have this box, or do you think you just stumbled upon it?
Well, I do think that somehow I was supposed to end up with it to figure it out. And that's what the rabbi said, because they said, why me, a Methodist guy from the Midwest? And he says, because we as Jews take for granted often what we have and what we know, and you will question everything. So you probably will figure it out quicker and more accurately than we might. You will ask for help from us, and we will look at it differently. So I do, and through prophetic dreams, this thing has appeared constantly through my life in the last 7 years in dreams, that it's doing what it's supposed to do. So in that sense, I guess, yeah, as much as anybody, I guess I was supposed to end up with it, but I don't know. That's the question now what to do with it. And so I just leave it in my den, in its Acacia Gold Line Ark, in a military shipping case.
That's a pretty hefty case, yeah.
With salt surrounding it and holy water on top of it, yeah.
With sage next, burning next to it. So, yeah. So do you think then that I feel silly saying if it wants you to, because it's an inanimate object, but if whatever is attached to the box has more that it wants you to do you think that that's something that you'll just know when the time is right then?
Well, here's the reality. I live in a Victorian home. I've known the family. They've all lived. They've all died. I have pictures. Things pass through our lives. They're the real things. And the thing is, no matter what, it's going to out-survive me. So it might be just biding its time. The last woman had it, 40 years before she died? And it really was kind of a little personal thing. As long as I live, I expect this thing to be with me. And then I hope it might be buried with me, but I can't even trust that. Who knows?
Yeah. Yeah. So how about you, Kevin? Do you think, is there any sense of fate or bad luck? Or
you want it back, Kevin?
Are you crazy? Yeah. Even with everything that's happened, Jason, there's nothing you could do to give me that box back. I can tell you, there are some things in life that I'm not certain about, and there are some things that I just have no idea about, and that's not one of them. There is nothing that would cause me, even to babysit it. I can honestly tell you that's the one definite thing I know in my life. That would never happen. As far as my involvement, I'll tell you, I've grown in the last 7 years to have some faith and confidence in Jason, believe it or not. I don't have any need or desire to have anything to do with this. And there are some other things associated with this that have taken place that I'm still kind of in the middle of, and I'm not going to elaborate on that. But as far as my involvement now, Jason is of the opinion, and with everything that I've seen take place while he's owned it, that there is a motion, there is a direction that this entire matter has taken, and whether or not the box is being dormant right now or not is a matter of conjecture. But I've decided that I will kind of throw in if Jason wants to have my two cents or you want to have my two cents, because I'm interested in seeing where exactly it's going. And apparently I'm not so close to the matter anymore that I'm suffering any effects. If it was something that I thought was still, you know, if I had things bouncing around my room or my mom was having strokes or something like that, you know, I wouldn't have anything to do with it. But I don't think that I really have any involvement other than I can offer my experience. And I'm interested in doing that because I have confidence. I think Jason is onto something. And I think I want to see what happens when his book is released and other people have the opportunity to put together the bits and pieces that he's assembled and draw some new conclusions. It'll be very, very interesting to see where it goes from there.
And I have to say with that, Kevin has actually submitted quite a bit of material that really, I think, enhances it. I mean, he's a key player. There's many players, but I have to say that if I had to say the person that I think makes the book work the most is because of my emails and letters and 7 years of correspondence with Kevin and drawing from that and the things that were still going on, it's all in there. And I do think it's a chronological book that will take you from before I knew about it to all the way up until I'm still finishing the edit, so it'll be up to this interview just about.
That's great. I'm really looking forward to the book because I know that I've talked to you extensively about it, but I just have this feeling that we've barely scratched the surface.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this the history behind it is so vast.
It can be, and the future also is wide open. And there's this sense of momentum, a sense of motion, a sense of purpose that as your listeners go and search for themselves, it'll make the connection and they'll find out.
Yeah.
They'll be part of the urban legend.
Exactly. Well, except it's not an urban legend, right? So I get a sense, Jason, that a couple things. First of all, that really more than anything, you feel like you're a steward of the box as opposed to an owner.
Yeah, a caretaker.
Yeah, and the other thing I think is that this has, in a lot of ways, been a really personal journey for you, too.
I think it has, and actually for my family, too. I have to say, more my children. My wife doesn't deal with this, doesn't want to have anything to do with it, doesn't believe anything like this. And so it's just like she's just removed herself from it, which I think is good. It creates a safe, the best way to protect yourself from something like this is to have no belief in it and no association with it. My kids have actually grown up from, you know, being 7 years old and 13 years old to young adults now, and they've changed with it as it's gone. And they're highly respectful of it, fearful of it. And so it's not in their face. As a matter of fact, most of the time, they've never known where it was, because I didn't want them to have any connection to it. And so, but I think in the end, it's been a good journey, and I don't think the journey's over yet. I think it's quietly sitting, but I'll even be curious as to what is next, whether it's 10 years or 20 years or what, you know, or next week. But I'm willing to just sit and wait and see.
So you don't think it's done with you then?
I don't know. No. I hope it is.
I think the interesting thing about it is there won't be any question when the next step comes. It always presents itself. It's always now apparent, and so you don't have to. I wonder if this is a new direction. No, when it happens and we're all in the middle of it, it will know.
Yeah, you know.
Yeah, you know.
So, Jason, somebody just asked in the chat room, and I know that we've alluded to it and actually even kind of said it, but they want to know where the box is now. And so could you describe the exact setup that – because I love the setup that you have for this box.
Hold on a second. It's not like in an underground bunker somewhere, you know, that shields it from, you know, any kind of nuclear warfare. It's in your house.
Well, actually, it was initially, I had it in the museum, and the staff wouldn't let it. I mean, it lasted 3 days in the museum, so that's how fearful and against it the staff were. So then it was in the back of my truck until my car, it was a brand new truck, not even 2 weeks old, started smelling like cat piss inside the entire truck. And so that was, you know, new car smell didn't last very long.
Yeah,
and it started freaking out my son, who was in the truck. He didn't know that literally it was traveling behind us, and I didn't like that thought either. Then it moved to basically my attic, then into an underground kind of crawl space basement, then to the house next door, which I bought as a rental, and nobody was living in it, and it stayed there for a long time. And so it's traveled, and then it went back to the museum until things started happening. I had to pull it back out again. Finally, with working with some Kabbalists, rabbis, and various scientists, we created what was an acacia ark, and even a little bit of Rabbi Gershon Winkler, who is the authority on Dybbuk's. We've communicated, and using some of his ideas that you use acacia wood, but you must use it vertically. I actually had the Amish create a container, kind of like the Ark of the Covenant, lined it in 24 karat gold, which as gold prices have gone up, when I bought the gold in 2006, it could not have been any cheaper. And now just the gold in it alone is probably $8,000.
Wow.
I mean, it's nuts. It's nuts how things work.
Maybe you should give me that box back.
Or at least the Ark. And so here it is the actual Dybbuk box is inside a wood, a rare wood of the temples of the Middle East and the Jews. So it's in this wooden ark lined in gold, and then it rests inside a foamed military case for like when you drop computer stuff out over Afghanistan. So it's a shock-proof, air-compressant container. These cost about $1,000. I was able to get it through surplus for a fraction of that. And so then it sits next to my little desk where I research and write and think. And there's a picture I sent you. I don't know where the picture's at, but you guys have a picture of what it looks like. Mm-hmm. Very unassuming.
Yes.
For now.
Except for the gold lining the ark, of course. Wow, that's amazing that you've gone to those links and that you've had those resources, which tells me that this is more than just a hobby. It's become something that's very meaningful, and you can say it's a hobby all you want, but sounds like it's moved beyond that.
But there's not a single thing that he's done there, though, in those modifications that he just described. Those weren't done because he has his whim. Each one of those little modifications were done because of something that took place that he was trying to either block it or insulate it. Or, you know, am I right, Jason?
Right. It took an entire year to get – the acacia wood grows in the Middle East. It's not an American tree. And if it does, no one's going to cut down a 50-year-old tree so you can make it into an ark. And it had to be from – I mean, I was giving all these requirements. The Jewish the Sefer HaRazam, I mean, when you look at the Book of Mysteries, they don't make anything easy. And so what I'm saying is it had to be one tree. It had to be 24-karat gold. It had to be – the Amish I took it to, it destroyed their planer. The wood is so hard, it's almost, that's why it's acacia. It grows so slow and sappy. It's almost like steel. It's like, what the hell is this?
But the acacia, Jason, that wasn't just like a design decision. I mean, there was a reason behind it. It wasn't just because you were trying to be trendy.
It's the sacred wood of the Jewish faith. And so if you're going to do it right, you have to get this. And so bit by bit, it took almost a full year to just get the thing together. But my thought was that this was to seal it, to put it away, and be done with it.
Did you notice the difference after you did that? And did you notice the difference?
And even, yeah, I did. Even if it was psychosomatic, absolutely everything stopped. And that was a good thing.
Mm.
That's what happened when I initially got rid of it also when I sold it on eBay. There was a palpable difference.
Wow.
An atmospheric difference.
Absolutely. Absolutely pressure change, yeah.
So
What is the wood that the box itself is made out of, the Dybbuk box?
It's called shittim or acacia. It actually grows in the desert. And
the Dybbuk box is acacia too?
Oh, the Dybbuk box itself is mahogany.
Oh, it's mahogany. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Very good.
So, we're going to, you guys want to talk about when the book is ready, where to buy, when the movie's coming out, your website?
Yeah, well, right now, Kevin and I have been working on his material and stuff, and I'm in final edits, so it actually has been reviewed. It is now just for, you do fact checks, people that, so you don't get sued. You got to make sure that if you use a quote from somebody that you have permissions, and so all that's happening right now, and it will go to the publisher in a couple weeks, and, the printing company, and by November, actually be available for people to enjoy, and you can go to the website, dybbukbox.com, and up at the left-hand corner is a link to tell you about the book, and you can pre-order it if you want. So, kind of excited about it.
I guess we
I'm totally
probably,
reading it.
Yeah, probably plug the Lionsgate. I'm sorry.
What's that?
I was going to say we could probably plug the Lionsgate project also from Ghost House Pictures and produced by Sam Raimi. The movie is coming out right now on January 6th is the international release date, and it'll be called The Possession. It may have a reference to the Dybbuk box, but for right now, the name was just changed to The Possession. Go ahead.
I was going to say, so if it's by Sam Raimi, are there going to be, zombies involved in this?
I don't think there will be any zombies involved, but...
Excellent.
Kira Sedgwick is a good actress, I guess.
I think just like we've been talking, it's more fearful when you don't see things as much as just knowing things. But I do think it's going to do very well. And one thing funny, I did get an email, and this is going to be a quote on the back of the book, because I wrote to the producers. I said, can you throw me a bone for a quote for the back of the book? And one of the executive producers said, well, let me tell you what actually happened. When we started to production, when we're getting ready to pick the cast and get ready to think about this film, Sam called us all together, and there were 10 of us, big, powerful people, and we're all sitting there, and he thought it would be best if maybe we had you bring it and had the real thing here, and that somebody would have to take care of it while it was in Hollywood. Of the 10, nobody agreed to it, but this executive said, well, I was game, so I said, but I'd have to ask my girlfriend. And so I went home, she knew about it, she goes, are you nuts? That thing is not coming in this home, you gotta be friggin' crazy. And so that was the end of the dialogue. The real box was not to come to Hollywood.
Wow,
that's amazing, guys. Thanks for coming on the show and talking about this.
This went by awfully fast. I'll tell you what, I'll be in line for your book, and I'll be in line for the movie, because the story fascinates me. It's a fascinating story. And Kevin, it's great to finally connect with you, because I've of course heard your story through Jason, but it's good to hear it from you.
Well, and I got to tell you guys something. I am your most hugest, wonderful fan of your site and what you're doing also. So it's a great honor to talk to you guys, and thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, okay, so go ahead, Jason.
Oh, no, I just want to thank Rick and Karen and Cheryl for keeping us connected.
Yay, Cheryl. So next week we are going to have NEPA Paranormal, Kathy and Katie Christopher, and they're going to be talking about their new show, which is called Ghost Detectives. It's going to be on the web and on local cable, as well as their recent investigations. So that'll be next week, and it will be 6 to 8 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 11 Eastern, and sorry, Jason, it'll be, and I say this for Rick every week, it'll be 8 o'clock or something in those flyover states.
Flyover states,
in those flyover states.
Yep, I'm in Chicago, it's
That's
the greatest
right.
city in the world, but it's still part of the flyover states.
That's right. So thank you, everybody, for joining us. We'll see you next week, Paranormal Underground Radio on Z-Talk Radio. Good night.
Thanks.
Good night, everyone.
Good night.
If you'd like to be a guest on Paranormal Underground Radio, email editor@paranormalunderground.net. Until next week, keep exploring the unexplained at www.paranormalunderground.net and join us again next week for Paranormal Underground Radio on the Z-Talk Radio Network.